Welcome to the October issue of the Aldi podcast. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Sarah Wheeler, an acclaimed writer and polar traveller. Early in her career, she was accepted by the US National Science Foundation as their first female writer-in-residence at the South Pole and spent 7 months in Antarctica. She has written many books on the topic of her travels, including Terra Incognita and The Magnetic North, about her time in Antarctica and the Arctic. She has also spent a lot of time in Russia, which is the subject of her upcoming book, Russia, The Mind and Stars, which reflects on the golden age of Russian literature and the reality of the country today. In the October issue, she has written a feature on Anton Chekhov's garden that was recreated earlier this year as an installation at the Royal Hampton Court Palace Flower Show. This Russian-themed garden was inspired by Melikhova, the country estate south of Moscow, where Chekhov lived in the 1890s and where he wrote The Seagull. It's often overlooked that Chekhov was also a doctor. In his orchard of cherries, medicinal herbs and conifers, he would treat patients with plants he had grown himself. The garden is the first step in a project to create a network of tranquil places for therapeutic use in England, Russia and the Ukraine. The garden has moved to the Colm Valley Integrated Centre for Health, led by Dr. Michael Dixon. The centre has been described as one of the most innovative surgeries in the country. In the context of this garden, the college is keen to demonstrate the role of the arts in health and the value of plants and herbs. Sarah Wheeler is lucky enough to have visited his Russian garden as well as the Royal Hampton Court Palace Flower Show garden. Sarah, do you think that the garden has been faithfully recreated at the Royal Hampton Court Palace Flower Show?
Yes, I do. I think both in its physical presence and in the ideas that it's trying to represent. See, Chekhov once wrote to a friend, he said, I think if I weren't a writer, I'd like to be a gardener. And he was a very keen horticulturalist, and almost until the end of his life, in between churning out masterpieces, he used to like reading seed catalogues for leisure. I kind of understand the kind of the therapeutic value of that kind of thing. I like to read the Argos catalogue myself. And he was also a very keen conservationist, and you'll remember Astroff and Uncle Vanya going on and on about how anxious he was about the chopping down of the Russian forest, which was fairly ahead of its time. I know that's a common trope now, but then it wasn't particularly. So Chekhov decided he wanted to plant as much as he could and conserve as much as he could, which he did at Melikhova, and he felt that the healing powers of nature, the therapeutic role of nature, and it wasn't sort of snake oil or homeopathy and that kind of thing. It was the fact that nature can have a healing role, and that was the idea of the garden he created at Melikhova, and the idea of the garden now. So they certainly is faithful in terms of what it looks like. There's a hay rick, for example, and a wooden bench, and lots of phlox plants, which were very common in that part of Russia. By the way, Melikhova is about an hour on the train south of Moscow, and it's open to the public. You can go there. And there's a samovar on the table, and the idea is that people can enjoy the balm of nature. There's apple trees, which there were at Melikhova. And you can certainly see now at Chekhov's house in Russia a lot of the things that he planted all those years ago still flourishing.
How hard do you think it was to get to recreate a Russian garden in the UK? And what lengths do you think they went to track down the Russian plants?
Well, according to the garden designers whom I met, it was really quite hard. There was a lot of historical research, a lot of collaboration with their colleagues, their counterparts in Russia, the people that tend the garden, Chekhov's garden there now. And also Anton Pavlovich himself, he wrote all kinds of letters and diaries and all kinds of things. And he often mentions the plantings he'd done. He got very frustrated, for example, because whatever type of rose he planted, the blooms were always white. And I think all gardeners are familiar with that things never quite turn out. But it was hard, certainly, to identify the plants. It was a big job. But I think it does, to my experience, having been to both, it does add an air of authenticity.
Often these pop-up gardens, by pop-up I mean at flower shows, can seem a little bit twee. It's tricky to become immersed in an idea recreated in such a small plot of land.
do you think that that wasn't a problem?
Yes, I think that, I mean, it is small, there's no question about it, but I felt that it did, as I've said, express some of his ideas, and the designers very much had that in mind. And in fact, the two people who conceived the idea are Chekhov scholars. One's Rosamund Bartlett, who's Chekhov's biographer, and they tried to encompass things that were important to him. So I think that it does express ideas. And of course, now that the garden has moved to Devon, it's in a garden environment. So it's not like it's in the centre of a concrete hospital or anything like that. It's in the centre of an integrated medicine complex, which already has a lot of outdoor spaces. And the idea is that it adds something different. And Chekhov himself, of course, being a very distinguished doctor, he didn't make any money from his doctoring. It was mostly he translated the local people for free. And every morning at Malikawa, there was a great long queue of people waiting. And if people were too sick to make it, a messenger would come. And Chekhov would ride off and go and treat them where they were. And of course, he once said very famously, spoke of medicine of his wife and writing as his mistress. But he later recycled the quip to say that fiction with his wife was his wife and the theatre was his mistress. So certainly the importance of healthcare, and not just for the rich, was something that was very close to Chekhov's heart.
In the piece, you describe the garden as a solace of a kind. Chekhov suffered from tuberculosis. In a piece in The Telegraph, it says that gardening took Chekhov's mind off dying. Is that what you mean?
Yes, I think it did. I mean, he started suffering from TB at quite a young age, and it was every spring, it was like sap rising, the blood coming out of his lungs. It was quite grim. And I think that's in the major plays, I think that sense of we shall endure, and we have to just grit our teeth and carry on, that's very strong. The acceptance of destiny is a very strong theme in the great plays. And I think that it's true that being in the garden, planting the garden, thinking about the garden, walking around the garden, producing goods that could be eaten or put on, you know, flowers for the table or whatever, I think it did take his mind off dying and the horror of it all. And don't forget, he was at medical school in Moscow, and so, you know, he'd seen life at the sharp end, you know, children syphilitic from birth, dying of starvation. That was his daily life. So he needed some sort of balm, both for his own illnesses and for the horrors he saw that, you know, life is not a bowl of cherries. And nature did that for him. There's a birch forest at Milikovo, and he used to walk in that. And yes, he found it a great solace. And the birds there as well, he was very interested in birds and wrote about them. And the whole sort of nature package, I think, did. And I think that's true for a lot of people, that it can sort of make you feel better, even if it's only temporarily, a walk in the woods or whatever. And he used to like the fact that he had proximity to nature, even when he was working at Milikovo. For example, his desk was by a window, and in the winter, the snowdrifts piled outside the window. Hares used to stand on them and look in at him. And he used to look in the hares' eyes and imagine them having personalities and all the rest of it. He was also a very keen angler, Chekhov, and at Milikovo he could fish in a pond in his garden from his bedroom. He just opened the bedroom window and put his line out, and he could fish. So it was this kind of proximity of nature and literature and creation in both senses of the word that I think appealed to him. And I think the idea of recreating the garden and having it at a health centre, and hopefully in the fullness of time, as you've said, there'll be other Chekhovian gardens which can sort of tour around, giving that sort of solace to people who are suffering.
You have brought up earlier in this podcast the quote by Chekhov, "I think that if I wasn't a writer, I could be a gardener." The writer-gardener is a tried and tested formula. You've got brilliant examples like Vita Sackville-West, Beatrix Potter, Wordsworth and Monty Donne. Do you think these two arts feed one another?
Well, it would seem so. I mean, I'm a writer, but I'm not a gardener. And there's certainly something about being a writer that means you don't like humanity very much. So I think probably being in a garden suits the writer's temperament to a certain extent. Yes, I do. It's creative, isn't it, in a different way. And, you know, you plant something in the ground and see it grow. It's a lot like a blank screen or a blank page as it was then. Suddenly accreting words and text and becoming something, taking on a life of its own, exactly like a garden does.
You mentioned the recurring feature of trees and woods in Chekhov's plays in your piece. A few examples are in The Seagull, Uncle Vanya and The Cherry Orchard. Do you think that Chekhov's horticultural interest is perceptible through an interest in his plays alone?
Well, he writes about woods a lot, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. He writes about woods and forests a lot, either descriptively, and don't forget in the short stories as well. You know, in Russia, that Chekhov's better known as a short story writer than he is as a playwright. And do you remember the lady with the little dog, all those descriptions of the scenery at Yalta, and the sun going down over the sea and this, that and the other. And so I think that, like many writers, it must be said, not all, but many great writers, there's an awful lot of nature, descriptions of woods, topography, stuff about the light, descriptions of the light, plants, birds. I think you could certainly tell, if you didn't know anything about the gardening, that this is a man who's very interested in nature and responds to nature.
In the piece, you also mentioned that there's a trend for healthy gardens. I've even heard them referred to as wellness gardens. You bring up Horatio's Garden, a charity that creates and maintains accessible gardens in NHS spinal centres. Why do you think that this trend has come about?
Well, I think that wellness is quite zeitgeisty, but in a good way. It's kind of holistic, without, as I said, go down the snake oil route. But the idea that treating the whole person. I was reading a piece a couple of days ago about why Weight Watchers is having a huge resurgence, and it's because they've shifted their emphasis from just calories and losing weight, which is quite a one-dimensional thing, to wellness, the concept of wellness. And I think that because it is zeitgeisty, all sorts of institutions in the caring and healing professions have caught on to the fact that you have to treat the soul and the mind as well as the body, which is a different thing to saying we're rejecting pharmaceuticals, because Chekhov certainly wouldn't have said that. He would have been amazed at what's available now compared to what he had to work with. But I think that it's a sign of the times, isn't it? And perhaps in troubled times, as we regrettably our own times are troubled, maybe people look for something that's more catering more to the whole organism. And I think conventional medicine has come to accept that. So yes, I think that the times have caught up with Chekhov. In that he would have said wellness and treating the whole body and the mind and so on. And I think we've sort of caught up with him.
And so you think that Chekhov would have approved of the healing gardens?
I think Chekhov would have completely approved and would have said, of course, despite the advances of modern medicine, sort of so amazing since his day, both in, as I say, in pharmaceuticals and surgery and every aspect, I think he would have said, but of course, you always have to cater to the overall well-being. And of course, we do a lot of palliative medicine these days. And so wellness very much creeps and comes into that, in the sense we're talking about is accepting you're not actually going to make this person well, but you can increase their well-being at the time by creating a nurturing environment. I think it's all about, yeah, creating a nurturing environment, which he did for himself and his family. And he would say is always essential component of what medicine is.
The Maggie's Cancer Centres have tried to do a similar thing with architecture to improve health, with various centres across the UK that have been designed by eminent architects like Zaha Hadid, Richard Rogers and Frank Gehry. The thought behind it being in the ability of buildings to uplift people. Do you think that a natural or built environment has a great impact on our physical and spiritual well-being?
Well, it's bound to, I think. What you look at is going to be stimulating, in a good way or in a bad way, I suppose, but bad don't know what stimulating badly is, but demoralising, I suppose, and depressing. So I think, yeah, what you look out at, and even the room you live in, the room you're in, you know, I think what you look at, the visual, the built environment, and the interiors of where you're living, particularly if you're sick and can't move around that much, I think is bound to have some sort of uplifting effect. And in fact, you know, if you look at the developmental progress of children in Romanian orphanages who have a pretty terrible environment even before they've developed their sensory skills, they're absorbing it, their developmental progress is very poor because they don't have any of that stimulation.
Russia is getting a bad reputation with the fixing of elections, the Salisbury poisoning, and Putin frequently being cast as a villain. Do you think it's still quite a sophisticated, beautiful literary place, or has the beauty of the 19th century died away?
Well, you can't. Those writers will never die away. Their work will never die away. Talk about the Golden Age, roughly, of Pushkin to the death of Tolstoy. And no amount of ghastly dictators can take away what those works achieve, and they break away from the confines of their period and enter the immortal zone, and that will never change. Likewise, the beauty of the Russian countryside. And you talk about change, but in fact very little has changed in Russia. It's always been terrible for ordinary people, and it still is. Regime after regime, nothing changes. That's why partly in my travels, for a book I've got coming out on Russia next year, I tried to avoid Moscow and Petersburg because they're not representative. It's the kind of 160 million other people struggling on, battling on. And Russia comes, you know, bumping along the bottom at almost all social indices. So it changes in lots of superficial ways, but it's just one rotten leadership replacing another, really. It's true that Russia has a terrible reputation at the moment, and there's some things, but for ordinary people, which is almost everybody, it's always been terrible, and it still is.
Finally, Chekhov's play The Seagull, which he wrote in The Garden at Melyhova, will be heading to, or will be screened at cinemas from the 7th of September. It will star Annette Bening and Saoirse Ronan. Will you be seeing it?
Absolutely, absolutely. As you know, there's been many translations, adaptations and productions, but as Tom Stoppard said, you can't have too many English seagulls.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah Wheeler. It's been brilliant to speak to you, and we're really looking forward to reading your piece in the October Oldie.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.